Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, so I just want to remind everyone, we Zoomed this the day before, so if something should happen on Wednesday night, we're not going to report it. Before we begin our first interview, and I'm actually quite excited about this, we're going to remind everyone that we begin every interview with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in October of 2019 during the impeachment hearings. It is powerful testimony about a remarkable man who said and reminded all of us that the reason his father came was because this was a place where you could celebrate freedom, and he assured his father he would be all right. And what we've come to learn is not only was he not all right, his twin brother was not all right, and as each day passes, the country is not all right. So now hear the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
The Nation magazine has been front and center in my life for a long time. John Nichols actually covered me when I ran for governor in 1992. He became an incredibly close friend. So as a result, I read it religiously every day. I also read The Guardian a lot. And I happen to notice that an article at The Guardian and an article at The Nation was written by the same professor. Joining us right now is Alex Vitale. He is a professor of sociology and the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and the author of the book, which I'll explain why he's here, The End of Policing. So let me welcome Alex to the program. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. How are you?
I am terrific. Let me just share a quick story because this will make you understand I've been on the same page as you for a long time. I may not have really understood that, but I have been. 1988, I was a young freshman legislator, or my second term, so I was very young. I was attending a state council of government event. I was on the committee that did state institutions. I'm sitting at a table, and at the table was the majority leader of the Illinois House of Representatives. And he made a statement that I will never forget and changed my life. And it goes directly to the articles you've written and the book you've written. And here's what he said. He said to us, "You know how we plan future prison beds in Illinois?" And we looked at him and we said, "No, how do you do it?" He said, "We go into the second grade class and we count the number of children at risk. And based on that number, we plan future prison beds." Every one of us looked at each other, and I almost started to cry. And I said, "They're seven. They're 7 years old." And that story, in some ways, changed my political life because I understood what needed to be done. And it wasn't more prisons, and it wasn't more police, and it wasn't a bigger defense budget, but it was investing in what people need. And that was 1988, Alex. Now we're looking at what happened to George Floyd, but he is just part of a long pattern. And you wrote a piece both at The Nation and at The Guardian, and the title of the piece from The Nation was, "The Only Solution is to Defund the Police. The murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor prove what we already know. Police reform has failed." Your piece at The Guardian The answer to police violence is not reform. It's the funding. Here's why. So please, that sounds so provocative, but as I read it, I kept going, oh my God, yes. Oh my God, yes. So talk to us about what we're all focusing on now, which is the concept of procedural justice. And what I learned is that what we really have to do is address substantive justice. And people need to understand what these two silos are and why one will produce results and the other one probably will not.
Great. Well, that is a very powerful story. And I have heard stories like that where it's just clear that our government just gives up on people. If we can identify who's at risk, why aren't we doing something to help them? To get to your excellent question. So, you know, after the killings, the police murders of Mike Brown and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice and so many others, we were told, don't worry. You know, the Obama administration, local mayors and police chiefs said, don't worry. We're going to fix it. We're going to fix policing. We're going to give them implicit bias training, de-escalation training. We're going to have community police encounter sessions. We're going to give them body cameras and everything's going to be fine. And it didn't work. All of this stuff is included under an umbrella of what we call procedural justice reforms. And procedural justice is based on this idea that if the police take the time to explain what they're doing, to hear your side of the story, and if they follow proper procedure in a professional and unbiased manner, then people feel better about the interaction, even if they get a ticket, even if they get arrested. But what this leaves us unexamined is the massive expansion in the role of police. We don't need to give narcotics units anti-bias training. We need to get rid of the war on drugs, right? The racism is built into the legal framework that the police are following. A totally lawful, procedurally proper drug arrest is still going to ruin someone's life for no good reason. There's no justice in it. It is substantively unjust. And we have to quit tinkering with the paperwork that the police fill out and the kind of training they have, and instead ask some really tough questions about why are we using police to solve every problem under the sun, especially in poor and non-white communities.
So let me just read a sentence from your Guardian piece. And you wrote, every social problem in poor and non-white communities has been turned over to the police to manage. The schools don't work? Let's create school policing. Mental health services are decimated? Ah, let's send in the police. Overdoses are epidemic? Let's criminalize people who share drugs. Young people are caught in a cycle of violence and despair? Let's call them super predators and put them in prison for life. I read that sentence and I was like, oh my God, that's the problem. If everything is perceived as a nail, then guess what? The only thing that works is a hammer. But let's also sort of speak to, because you're absolutely right, you know why we like procedural justice versus substantive justice. Because procedural justice is a cheaper switch. You think you're fixing it because, oh, you know, how much is, you know, a couple of cameras? How much is training? The kind of substantive justice that you're talking about requires long-term systemic investment and recognizing the incredible inequities that exist in our society.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not just that the reforms themselves are cheap. We've actually plowed, you know, millions of dollars into these reforms. But in the procedural justice folks are part of an ideology that is unwilling to ask these deeper questions about the direction of our country. They just take for granted that policing is an appropriate tool in all the ways that it's being used, and that we just need to get the public to trust the police more, right? It's like it's our fault that we don't trust the police, and they just need to convince us why the police are good or something. Instead of asking, you know, what does it mean when we turn a problem over to the police to manage? What tools do the police have to solve our community problems? They've got guns and handcuffs and nightsticks and ticket books. They don't have affordable housing. They don't have mental health services. They don't have jobs for our young people. They don't have medically qualified drug treatment services. Those are the things that will actually make our communities stronger and healthier. So every time we turn a problem over to the police to manage, we're placing a burden on those communities. And because it's so targeted at communities of color, it's reproducing racial inequality. It's making it worse.
And the other thing that you mentioned and that I have been fighting against is that what we've also done is we've militarized the police. So now not only do we call it a war on drugs or a war on poverty, and we thought, oh, we don't mean real war. Well, wait a minute. Have you seen the Bearcats? Have you seen the guns? Have you seen the equipment? You know, all of a sudden we had all this extra military equipment. Well, let's give it to the cops. Why? They're not in a war, but maybe I'm wrong. They are in a war. And that's exactly what we saw just the other day in front of the White House.
Yeah, well, the politicians have told the police that they are at war with large segments of the population. As you mentioned, a war on drugs, a war on crime, a war on gangs, a war on immigrants, a war on terror, right? Every problem is being framed in these warrior terms. And then we give the police more money, more toys. And then when they overreact, we are like, oh my God, we need to give them some training. No, take their toys away.
I saw a story and I went and found the article from Forbes magazine from 2017. It was incredible. It was just, and I posted the graph because I was so out of my mind. They did two things in this graph. The question was, how much do US cities spend on policing? Now remember everyone, this is from 2017, so it's a little bit dated. And of course, the city that spends the most money on police is New York City, all right? And New York City at the time was spending $4.89 billion with a B of policing. But this is what was so interesting to me, Alex, is that it was only 8.2% of its budget. Now let me take you to Minneapolis, Minnesota. I went to school at St. Olaf College, so I know Minnesota very well. Minneapolis was spending $163.2 million. No. Don't look at the number. Look at the percentage of the Minneapolis city budget. It was 35.8%. I believe it was the third highest percentage of any city in the United States. And the question that you pose, and the question that immediately jumped into my mind, if they're spending that much freaking money on the police, then what are they not spending money on that people ultimately need that could change their lives and invest in them?
Yeah, and there are cities that spend even more, over 40%. Yeah. And that does not include what they spend on jails and courts on top of it. So that for Minneapolis, when you add those expenses in, it's over 50% of the city's budget goes into criminalization. And while the number seems lower in New York, it's a little misleading, in part because in New York, we run a massive hospital system,
right,
and also a massive mass transit system that is funneled through the local budget in large part. And also there are a lot of hidden costs. Pension costs and healthcare costs for police are not included in that percentage. So there's a lot of budget chicanery there. But the thing is, since that report came out, the NYPD budget is now over $6 billion.
God.
So last week, we called for cutting that budget by $1 billion over 4 years.
So Alex, as I get it. So now my question is, are we at a tipping point? But my problem is the tipping point the procedural tipping point where everyone says, oh, let's do the accountability. Let's do more kumbaya and teach them how to be nicer when they arrest you. Or is it going to be actually the substantive one? Because what we have seen in a way from the pandemic has given us an opportunity not to tip into the procedural justice, but to really tip into the substantive one, because what we have seen from this pandemic is that it has ripped the scab off of every single rotten thing that you have been aware of and I have been aware of for decades. We've been talking about it, but no one's been listening to us. And now it is erupting in death, in inequality, in job loss, in, I mean, just everything you could possibly imagine is pointing to look at this flawed system. And not only do we have the flawed system, but we have the murder of George Floyd. We can deal with that. We can do some of the procedural accountability, but the only way not to have another George Floyd is to do what you said, is to defund the police, but not just defund them in isolation. It's to put the money into things that will ultimately make a difference.
Yeah, you know, there's a kind of hopefulness and pessimism at work right now. I think at the federal level, I'm a bit pessimistic, because obviously we see what's going on with the Trump administration. This is horrible. This is, you know, verging on fascism. But unfortunately, the mainstream of the Democratic Party has not learned anything. You have Obama and his former DOJ officials and Kamala Harris and everyone else trotting out the exact same reforms that they trotted out 5 years ago. They have learned nothing, because they don't want to address these deep inequalities built into American society, because this would require a kind of political will that's lacking.
Okay. So an article just came out of Politico, and I posted it on Facebook and I tweeted it out. And the article said that Joe Biden is now embracing a revolutionary agenda. And I'm like, what? Joe Biden? And so I read the article. And let me tell you what I have been saying. My audience and my producers are probably going to shoot me. But I have said ad nauseum, I've known Joe for decades, Alex. I know him, okay? And he is not imaginative or creative or a great leader. He never has. He's kind of like interesting wallpaper, okay? He's a nice guy, though. But what I do know, and I've said this over and over again, is that Joe leads from behind. Now, here's what's happened at the moment. Is that this is a revolutionary moment, all right? And that is a revolution not of the procedural justice, but of the substantive justice. Because the revolution is pointing to the inequality, the healthcare, the climate change, the all the money going to the top 1%, you know, all those things. What's happened with the military budget? What's happened with the police budget? And what this article said was, is that all of a sudden, Joe is beginning to adopt the language of the revolutionary. And I'm sitting there going, check my pulse. But you know what? So far, there's nothing more than that. But in the article at Politico, Andrew Yang said, so here's the good news. So Andrew Yang kind of said what I said, is that Joe is kind of pragmatic. Like, he's not wedded to much, okay? And that may actually be a good thing, because he's not an ideologue of that situation. He can sort of look at what's happening on the ground and saying, what is necessary for me to respond? And the status quo ain't working. So there is that hope, Alex, that maybe of all the people, like Nixon opening China, maybe Wallpaper Joe will do something that we thought Barack Obama might have the capacity to do and only sort of depressed us. And it might come out that his old sleepy Joe will be the one to do it, because maybe the moment has given him the opportunity to do what Obama could not.
Well, I hope you're right. And I know there are some members of Congress who are starting to articulate this message. Ayanna Pressley has put out some really good stuff that's kind of in a justice reinvestment framework that I fully support. But where I think we're going to see more immediate progress is in local struggles. You know, even before this recent uprising, there were dozens of cities where people had been organizing to defund the police, to dial back the police budget. And they're now emboldened and they're finding new allies. Recently, Nashville, that had a robust campaign to decrease funding for the police, they had a public hearing, and they had to keep the public hearing going until 4:30 in the morning. because there were basically 10 straight hours of people wanting to testify about why they needed to defund the police. Minneapolis has cut its contract with the Minneapolis School District has cut its contract for school policing. I think we're going to see more of these concrete victories of dialing back our reliance on policing, regardless of what happens at the federal level, because ultimately policing is a local matter.
Yes.
It's not under federal control.
Yes. So Alex, as you write about in the article again at The Nation, the only solution is to defund the police. The murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor prove what we already knew, police reform has failed. So as I'm reading your articles, it also, I'm the daughter of two public school teachers from New York City. Okay. One of the things I remember my dad kept saying, and we see it now in bold relief, is that the other place that's sort of become the dumping ground for every problem that we don't want to solve is education. We're feeding everybody, okay? We're providing the nurse for the kids who don't have access to a doctor. We're providing the mental health services, only we call it special ed. We're providing mittens and clothing and
laundry services.
Like, right, exactly. So I feel like both the schools and the police have been the sort of convenient place to sort of hide the problem, not address the problem, somehow think that you're going to get a result. And what you're doing is you're telling teachers, you're not going to have time to teach because you're going to have to provide more mental health counseling than you are teaching the ABCs. And to a large extent, these two stories of policing and education are parallel. It's the same, track. And both of them are screaming out for some kind of a different response.
One thing we can think about schools is that that is the one institution often in our poorest communities that has some credibility in a way that the police don't.
Yeah.
And there are some ideas about how to leverage that. That there's what's called a community schools model. They've experimented with this in New York. Some states out west have been working on this. And the idea is that the school needs to be a resource, not in the classroom exactly, but when classes are over, on the weekends,
right.
They could be a source of better nutrition, but also things like family services, counseling.
Right.
And during the school day, we need to get rid of the school police and put back the social workers and the counselors and the teacher's aides and the high-quality after-school programs and the enrichment opportunities, right? So schools could be a vector for a lot of really positive things, but only if we get the police out of there.
Well, and the reason why I mentioned schools and policing is that, so policing is getting more money for the procedural whatever. Schools are getting the same amount of money with the increased responsibility and yet without the kind of resources they need to respond to that increased responsibility. So, you know, you're seeing bigger classrooms and yet you're seeing more needs. I remember because of the opioid epidemic, you are seeing so many damaged kids coming into school and they're coming in now in droves because it was their parents that overdosed and grandparents that are raising them. No one has talked about the opioid epidemic and what it means for five-year-olds. They haven't made the connection. And you're absolutely right. We'll throw the cops at the kids to bust the parents. But guess what? They have children, you know, and how are we dealing with their children? So I do think that this gives us such an incredible opportunity to have such a robust conversation. And as I know that you teach in Brooklyn College, I do want to remind everyone that one of the things that I had to admire Bill de Blasio for was that we know people are hungry. And Bill de Blasio originally did what most schools did. They realized that they're feeding the kids because these kids are now not in school, but they still need to be fed. So the schools needed to somehow figure out how to still feed these kids, even if they were teaching them remote. And then they realized, well, if they were hungry, maybe their parents were hungry. So they said the parents could come and eat. And then Bill de Blasio did something really, I thought, quite remarkable. He said, anybody can come and eat. And your point about the fact that the schools can be so much more, to me, was really sort of expressed in that decision to make the schools the place where you didn't have to explain why you were hungry. You just needed to say, I need a meal. And I think that really sort of speaks to a little bit about how we need to respond and respond differently, because those are the kinds of investments we need to make. And maybe the schools can be that place, but they can't be that place if they don't get the kind of robust investment and the understanding that it requires the dollars and the social worker and the food and the after school program and all those things.
And ultimately, you know, it shouldn't all be in the school. We need to build community centers, community kitchens, things like that. But for now, that's the resource that's available.
Well, I'm hoping that the Politico article that you better read, Alex, today is true. And maybe the fact that it's even written means it's a billboard and he's going to have to sort of address it because people are going to say, well, wait a minute, what about the FDR agenda? What about this revolutionary agenda? Don't tell me you're sliding. To a large extent, it keeps pushing him forward. And then the kind of articles that you are writing, God, I hope you're on MSNBC. I hope you're on CNN. I want people to understand that as you're looking for police accountability, the best way to assure there's not another George Floyd is, as you point out, to basically take that funding away from that force and put it into the investment of substantive justice. And that's what we need to do. Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College and the author of the book that everyone needs to read right now, The End of Policing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great conversation. My pleasure.
You're welcome. All right, everyone, stick around. We're also having Russ Muirhead, the head of the government department at Dartmouth College, because there's just too much to unwrap, especially given Donald Trump. We'll be right back.
Gardens growing clean water on this current cast. When it rains, the runoff picks up pollution. Fertilizers, herbicides, and oils are carried across hard surfaces, through drains, and into our rivers, lakes, and oceans. Now people are creating rain gardens, directing storm water runoff to shallow depressions in the landscape where it's held long enough to seep into the ground. Pollutants are filtered out or broken down as they move through the soil and into the groundwater supply. With native plants, a rain garden can be a beautiful, low-maintenance, and low-cost way to attract birds and butterflies, too. Your garden may start in the gutter, but it can end up bringing clean water and new life to the land. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Are we gonna keep pushing our children to drugs? Are we gonna keep driving them insane? Are we gonna keep laying empty words and fists? Are we gonna be remembered as the century that failed? People of America, when will we learn?
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. Again, a reminder, we Zoom on Wednesday, so if something horrific happens Wednesday night, Russ Muirhead, the head of the government department at Dartmouth College, is not going to be able to comment on it. But after seeing what happened this week, and Russ, every day now feels like a year. Every day, I keep thinking it can't get any worse, and it does. And, you know, we're still reacting to the pandemic. We're still reacting to an economy that's just plummeted. We're still reacting to the murder of George Floyd. And then we see our president threatening martial law, and we're watching his behavior. What I am so shocked about is not his behavior. It is the Republican Party that is just so terrified of responding. And when you see, you know, they're talking about all those cops, Russ, who were with Chauvin when he had his knee on the neck of George Floyd.
Right.
And they were really accomplices in murder. I am now looking at the Republican Party, and they are accomplices too, because they are accomplices to a despot, to a dictator, to an authoritarian who is dismantling this government. And they are just like those other cops. They are accomplices. When do we start calling them what they are?
Right, that's right. I mean, he captured the party in the first, you know, year of his presidency. I thought Jeff Flake, I thought that would be the model for how any Ben Sasse from Nebraska, I thought they'd be models for how thoughtful Republicans would handle the president, and I conceded that it was a difficult place to be, to be a thoughtful Republican senator in you know, December 2016. They've been run out of the party. They were run out very early, and the likes of Tom Cotton, you know, filled the gap. Tom Cotton is studying at the feet of Donald Trump. He's much smarter and he's much more disciplined than Donald Trump. He has no more scruples. He's just as willing to use every tool, the conspiracy theorizing, the threats, the scapegoating. He's just as willing to use all of that as Trump, but with even more capacity. And so I guess that, you know, a lot of Republicans think Trump is a one-off. The party will recover after he leaves. He's an unrepeatable element in you know, American politics. But I think it's really an open question whether Trump permanently corrupts the soul of the Republican Party.
For the first time, I kind of feel sorry for Romney, but I kind of don't, because he's sort of privileged, you know? And he's always been privileged. He's been privileged because of his wealth. He's been privileged because he lives now in Utah, which is where he's sort of surrounded by a moat of people who didn't necessarily, weren't impressed with Donald Trump. He has this sort of protective sphere around him. And what I don't quite understand is that how important is re-election than your country?
Yeah, that's the great question for these Republicans. You're absolutely right. I mean, some things got to be more important. This was the question that they had to answer in impeachment. And you're right. Romney didn't quite face being run out of his, you know, of his seat as a consequence of his stand in impeachment. But nonetheless, I think we should give him credit for, you know,
yes,
for the stand he took. It was still a lonely one, yeah, and therefore a courageous one.
So as we're looking at these Republicans who clearly don't understand the definition of patriotism, Donald Trump keeps talking about the war and about the courage of all these people. And I'm looking at the Republican Party that has absolutely exhibited no courage. They're willing to sacrifice nothing. I'm almost wondering if there was, given the kind of behavior we're seeing now, this ability for them to suddenly begin to speak out and recognize that Donald Trump has sort of captured the soul, but I'm not sure that Donald Trump could handle 20 senators speaking out against him. He's a coward. He's a bully.
Yes.
And if all of a sudden they went back to their constituents and said, I understand what you see. Now let me tell you why I need to come to you and say it has gotten too far.
Right.
And it can't be one or two. It has to be a critical mass. But once you hit that critical mass, one, I think they figure out a way to rebuild their party. And I also think it's a way to be able to sort of prove what kind of a coward Trump is.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. He's so afraid, speaking of cowardliness, he's so afraid of anything that might communicate weakness.
Yeah.
And of course, I think the best leaders understand how a concession of weakness can sometimes be a source of strength, which is to say all of us human beings are weak and we're all mortal. That's our weakness, among others. Ultimately, that's our ultimate weakness. And the best leaders identify with human beings, empathize with the vulnerability and the weakness of human beings, and reveal their own and get stronger because of it. Trump, he can't admit that he's human. He can't empathize. He really has a problem admitting the existence of other human beings, the independent existence. We all exist for him. This is now what's making him so profoundly dangerous. I mean, he's threatening to call out the United States military. Now the question isn't just, will Republican senators stand up to him? And you're right, 20 senators could contain him.
That's absolutely true. They could, and that's what, and I know that 20 senators have to go to bed at night going, what the frick is going on? And yet that they don't have a spine and that they don't have courage. I mean, part of me begins to think I really want term limits. And part of the reason I want term limits is that these guys have sort of proven that they've been sort of insulated from reality. And as a result, it's all about reelection. And it isn't about policy. It isn't about governing. It's about being there. It's about being there. And that's not what the job was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be a temporary position. You were supposed to go home. So many of these people never go home. And I think that that's part of it, is that that's what's so wrong. And now they're willing to sacrifice their country so they can be there after November. Why is it worth it?
Yeah, and that's right. No, they, I think it is. This is what we mean by corruption. And now I think the question is, will the generals stand up to him? Yeah. Will the generals follow an illegal order? I mean, that was what was so chilling about Lafayette Park the other night, is that we saw the military willing to commit violence against peaceful protesters and American citizens on the orders of the commander in chief, orders that were probably illegal and certainly had no basis, so that he could walk across and stand in front of a troop, really so that he could just show what toughness, what violence looks like. He despises the governors who refused to just commit large scale violence. And he wanted to give people a glimpse of what he would do, what he's ready to do, what he wants to do.
I think his biggest frustration with COVID-19 is that he calls himself a wartime president, but he can't see the enemy, the virus.
Yeah, well,
so what he loves about what's happening with the riots and the chaos in the streets is that now he can create an enemy he can see.
Yeah.
Now he can be the real wartime general, because now he is someone he can shoot. Now he is someone he can arrest. He can't arrest a virus. It is making him crazy, because it is killing people. It is decimating the economy. It is pointing out all the inequity. And he talks about being a wartime president, but he's not bored with the pandemic. He's frustrated with the pandemic because he doesn't know how to fight it, because he can't shoot it, arrest it, marginalize it, and point at it. And now he has something he can. And I think he thinks that this is his way of getting the older voter back. You see, the pandemic was killing them and he didn't care, or he didn't know how to address it. But now, because of the idea of safety and security and stability, he thinks that his, being tough on what's happening in the streets is his way of sort of roping them back in, because he's going to protect them.
Yeah, and very few people, he's found some traction. He's found a little bit of traction. People don't resonate with those who throw Molotov cocktails into police cars. People don't resonate with looters. Nowhere, no demographic, no region. And when they see that, they want law and order, law in an orderly way. And so, he thinks it can be now the law and order president, but it's actually, what he's offering is not law and it's not order. It's a different kind of illegality and it's a different kind of violence, actually a kind that's much more fearsome than what you'd see in a night of looting. And it's deploying the United States military in the homeland against American citizens. As you said, it's martial law. So I actually don't think that's going to resonate. I think what's happening now is people are looking at their country and they're seeing a kind of destruction and threat on a scale unlike anything in anyone's lifetime, from the inability to deal with something that we should have been able to deal with, this pandemic, to chaos, to police who are murdering people, having been egged on, not, you know, by a president throughout his term. And I don't think that they're going to then side with President Trump and say he will restore order. I think this is not going to offer him much hope.
There was an article, I believe it's Slate.com. It really did say, is it different this time? And I do think it's different this time. And I think in part, it's not just the 8 minutes and 40 seconds and the people trying to say, you're killing him, get off of him, and being, you know, pepper sprayed or being pushed away. We see it in incredible bold relief. But I will tell you, I think the thing that is as valuable as the 8 minute video is that the policeman had his hands in his pockets. As he is killing George Floyd, he is like Donald Trump, disinterested.
Yeah.
Disinterested in life. Disinterested in what the consequence of his actions are. And I almost want to split screen because his sort of vacant lot face is the same as Donald Trump. It's this lack of caring, this lack of humanity. And I think that's one of the reasons why he is not going to be successful, because he has touched a place that I don't think we've ever been before. And we now even have it on film.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think this one is different. You could see it, you could hear it in the immediate aftermath of the video going public, in the comments by police officers, sitting police officers, police chiefs all over the country, and by retired police officers. I mean, this was the occasion when police professionals did not rally around one of their own, but rather, you know, looked on in horror and said, you know, that there's no defense, there's no account that can be given that would justify what I just saw. And that was the beginning. That was the first sign that this is something different. I think the unity.
Yeah, but the police, let me just say something. And we see this with the Minneapolis police chief and with other police chiefs. And there's a sort of a line of demarcation. There are the police chiefs and some of the cops who've seen this and are horrified. The problem isn't them. It's the police unions. And the police union came out immediately in defense of all those cops. Okay?
Yeah.
And the police unions are actually, I see the police unions as an extension of the NRA. I don't see them as an extension of unions. I don't see them as an extension of safety and security. I see them as part of sort of the militaristic police that kind of are supported by the concept of the NRA, that like the idea of the Second Amendment before they like the idea of the First Amendment. And so you've got this sort of bifurcated concept of what is policing. You've got the chiefs that really do kind of understand what's wrong, and yet they can't even fight it if there's no accountability, in part because of what has happened through the court system, but what has happened because of the unions.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, you're absolutely right. It's the same thing in Rikers Island. It's very, very hard to get any reform there because of the, you know, correctional officer, Brotherhood of Correctional Officers, not because, you know, management or the elected officials. So this is, you know, a fundamental problem. You're right.
So there was an article that came out of Politico, and I mentioned it in the first half, and I'm going to mention it to you. Here's the title. Biden begins to map out, here's the word, revolutionary agenda, reimagining his presidency amid national upheaval. And I'm looking at the word going, revolutionary? That's Bernie's word. That's not Biden's word. But it appears that in the last couple of days, maybe in a couple of weeks, his language has started to change. And it's almost like he is responding to the moment. And while he may have assured a lot of his supporters or funders or whatever that he will not be transformational, he's just going to go back and make things nice and whatever, I think what he is seeing happening as a result, again, of the pandemic, as a result of George Floyd, as a result of the potential martial law of this president, as a result of what's happening with climate change and the rest of the world looking at us appalled, I think he is realizing that the moment is requiring more. Do you think that's possible?
I have low expectations for our man, Joe Biden. So is it possible? Gosh, wouldn't that be something if he could read the situation and respond so imaginatively as you just described, and with such, with an ability to innovate and to become something different than what he's always been. That would be terrific. I mean, I've always thought that, when Joe Biden went to the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Wilmington, he stayed for an hour. He listened. He took notes. He spoke a little bit. There were no photo ops. There was nothing to really send out on social media. As Charles Sykes at the Bulwark said, Biden didn't own anybody. He didn't break new ground. He didn't do anything super quotable. He just demonstrated quiet decency. And that used to be very normal in our politics. And what I think Joe Biden promises is that it might become normal again. And that's what I think, that's real. That's what Joe is. He's a quiet, decent guy. And right now, displaying that, being who he is, I think, a profound contribution to our politics. If he can be even more, bravo.
All right, so I've known Joe for a long time. And, again, because I've covered presidential politics and Joe has been on and off running, and then, of course, I ran for Congress. So, we've kind of entered each other's orbit, whether I liked it or not. That was what it is. And I always tell people that I was telling these people before that in 96 when I ran for Congress, I ran against everything he voted for. I ran against the crime bill. I ran against the welfare reform bill. So I'm running against Joe and my president at the same time. What a wonderful way to run as a Democrat. Anyway, that's a little bit of my history. But let me just say something about Joe. And that is, Joe reflects the party of the moment. And the party of the moment was for the crime bill. Bernie voted for the crime bill. When you look at the party of the moment, a lot of the Democrats voted for the welfare reform bill. It was the new Democratic Party of Bill Clinton. So Biden doesn't change what's around him. He becomes what's around him. What we saw with the almost martial law of the other night is a party that is appalled at what they see. What they saw with George Floyd is they're appalled at what they see. What we suddenly realize is that if you don't have a job, you don't have health care, and they're appalled at what they see. And all of a sudden we're realizing who's dying, and it's African Americans, and it's Hispanics, and it's the poor, because guess what? They have all the underlying conditions. And I think that he is witnessing not only a browning of the electorate and a changing of the electorate, but a new demand on the party and, frankly, on him.
Yeah. So you think he really will read that moment. He'll read this moment.
Yes.
He'll understand how it's different, and he will actually have the imagination and capacity to respond and be something different.
Right, but can't you be different and not be you? In the sense that someone asked me once, who is my best example of leadership? Okay, I was running for governor. Like, who was I? Did I mention Desmond Tutu? Did I was going to mention? And you know who I mentioned? I mentioned my Girl Scout camp director. And they looked at me and went, that's your model for leadership? And I said, yes. And they said, why? Of course, they had never had a woman running for governor anyway. So to mention the Girl Scout camp directorship was really off their radar. But Russ, you know why I mentioned her? Because she empowered us. She brought in the best staff. She recognized their talents. And she let us deliver on those talents. And what made her remarkable wasn't that she was the thinker and the great leader. It was that she had surrounded herself with people who made a great team and were able to sort of fill in all the gaps in her ability in order to make a better sort of not only leadership team, but a more productive camp setting. And I see Joe as recognizing his limitations.
Well, wouldn't that be great? I mean, I think, you know, maybe a lot will depend. I mean, Joe, on who he picks as a VP. He has a chance to frame the party for the future, not just in what he would accomplish as a president, but in the talent that he cultivates. And so you're suggesting that he'll read the moment and he'll take the, you know, the party in a new direction. And if he were to win the country, and, you know, I suspect that his ability to do that will depend not just on what he does, but what his VP does and who she is.
So who should she be? So if Russ Muirhead, if you had a magic wand and Russ Muirhead was trying to figure out who would send a powerful message, who would be able to sort of fill one of those gaps in Joe Biden's sort of empty resume of sort of excitement and news and whatever. I mean, I hate to say this, but I heard him speak again, and I know it's going to be a woman, but I heard Cory Booker on MSNBC the other night. And I have to tell you, and I know Ken is listening, Ken Barnes, my other producer, every time I hear Cory Booker speak, I know he's got some issues in his portfolio. But let me tell you, if anybody could excite me and look to the better angel in me and send the country in the right direction, maybe we can, I don't know if there's a woman who has that kind of capacity, but I would love a voice like that, because it is a voice of morality. It is a voice of hope. It is a voice of understanding. The fact that he's from Newark, I mean, it's just, it's all those things. I want the female Cory Booker is what I'm looking for. So who are you?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're really saying is that this is another moment where Joe maybe shouldn't have pre-committed to the gender of his VP candidate. And I think you're right that given the last 5 days of what's happened in our country, not to mention, you know, the last 3 months, the moral force of Cory Booker's voice, the prophetic and inspirational component that he has, which distinguishes him from everybody, it suddenly seems like something that is not superfluous, that's not merely style, but might be, you know, fundamental. And yeah, I'm with you there very much, Arnie.
Well, Russ Muirhead, you're with me right now. So thank you so much for joining us. Russ Muirhead is the chair of the government department at Dartmouth College. I called him at the last minute after watching what was going on in Washington, going, I need to talk to Russ. Thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artisan, and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. Thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think. Let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back. Just